Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Every year on June 19th, Americans celebrate Juneteenth, a holiday that commemorates the end of slavery in the United States. This week, we'll travel to Whitney Plantation, where the focus is entirely on the slaves who lived there instead of the slave owners. New Orleans developer John Cummings is the visionary behind the project. We'll hear from John about what inspired him to invest millions of dollars of his own money to bring focus to the truth of slavery in the antebellum South. Dr. Ibrahim Asek is John's in-residence research director. He'll personally give us a tour of the property and share his findings and the amazing untold stories of the Whitney Plantation slaves. Then, educator and activist Sybil Morial, who was once New Orleans' first lady, tells the tale of discovering her own family ties to the Hydells of Whitney Plantation. We're taking a long look at the reality of the plantation life of slaves on this week's Louisiana Eats. The vision for the Whitney Slavery Museum originated with one man, John Cummings. With social responsibility on his mind and the research direction of Professor Ibrahim Asek by his side, John invested $10 million of his own money, creating the first plantation museum dedicated to memorializing the truths of slavery. John spoke with us about how this momentous project began.
I bought it 16 years ago, and I'm an attorney of offices here, Philadelphia and Seattle, and did well. I'm retired now. And whatever Uncle Sam and the bartender let me keep, I invested in real estate, and I bought the Whitney Plantation as a real estate investment. It came with 8 volumes of a study, and I read some interesting parts of it. The architectural part of it was very interesting, but what really changed my life was when I got to the section on successions and the passage of ownership from one to the other. And for the first time in my life, I realized that the story of slavery had not been included in my education. And I saw the inventories and realized that the second most valuable asset on the plantation were the slaves. And every slave in the inventory would be given a number, his name or her name, how old, the age, and then the job of that enslaved human being on the plantation, and then a section for comments. I then realized that there was such a thing as oral histories from the slaves. And there's some you can get that go back to the 1400s. But the big contributor there was the Works Progress Administration from about 1929-32. And people went out into the fields to interview ex-slaves. And we own, I think, about 2,400 of those oral histories. And I started to read them. And I'll never forget, I had to put the book down because I cried. And you out there, you went into the Midlow Hall, L.A.,
yes.
We have the 107,000 names, and every slab has 2 quotes from the slaves. And I've seen many people that when they read them, they have a meltdown. They become verklempt and they don't know what to do. It should surprise no one that a rich white boy is in this endeavor, because you have to remember, it was a whole lot of rich white boys who started this. Now, what in the hell do you do with that if you have the same skin that you and I have? What do you do with that You grieve. You know there's something that you should do. You feel a responsibility. And indeed, you have a responsibility with that. But this is the first time that the majority of the 34,000 people who came through there last year, first time that they have ever seen the raw facts of slavery, the brutality of slavery. But you have to do something. You can know, like me, I could no longer be a pedestrian. I could not. I looked at it and then checked on education. It was, we were never educated on any of this. And my commitment to the memory of all of those people was that I would get those facts. And as best we could, we would bring those to the attention of everybody we could find. Now, we know we can't rewrite history, but we can right some of the wrongs of history, especially in education.
John Cummings, owner of the Whitney Plantation and Slavery Museum. The Whitney Plantation is one of three surviving Civil War era sugar plantations located in St. John the Baptist Parish, about an hour's drive from New Orleans along the Mississippi River. The Louisiana Eats crew arrived on an overcast, windy morning and were greeted by Professor Ibrahim Asek, who would serve as our personal tour guide.
My name is Ibrahim Asek. To make it easier for you, you can call me Dr. Sek. I'm the director of research here since 2000.
Dr. Sek led us outside to a golf cart that would provide transportation around the plantation's grounds. Our first stop was a restored 19th century structure donated by the Antioch Baptist Church congregation in 2001. It had been moved from its original site in Paulina, Louisiana. As I entered the church, I was immediately struck by the arresting and lifelike statues of children, 40 in all, barely tall enough to see over the tops of the pews.
So these are the children of Whitney. They represent the people who were enslaved all over the South and who were interviewed in the 1930s by the Federal Writers Project. And it is just amazing and heartbreaking to see that these wonderful children, they had some dreams. Every child is a dreamer. Every human being is a dreamer, especially when you are young, growing up. You know, you think about them having to drop those dreams, living in the big house with the children of the master, and you may think you belong to that big house. And at what time in your life they let you know that you are nothing but a slave, and you have to grow up learning to be a slave and serving the little masters who later will become the big master. That's your fate.
Are there any of the children that you see their statues all the time who speak to you specially?
Of course, every child around here speaks to me. The person who came with the idea is a specialist of psychology. Mm-hmm. And he told Cummings, if you really want to reach everybody on this planet, tell the story of slavery through children, because it is a universal tendency to really listen to children. When we all stand here, black, white, Chinese, or whatever, whenever you hear a child crying, everybody, you know, turns his head or her head to see. That's why we decided to do it.
Not far from the church, Dr. Sek took us to a large monument comprised of gray granite slabs engraved with names and information about the Haydel Plantation slaves. What is this monument, Dr. Sek?
This monument is dedicated to all the people who were enslaved on the Haydel Plantation. We call it the Wall of Honor. Here we honor the memories of all the people who were enslaved here only. And these names are not fake. We found them in inventories done throughout the 18th century and into the 19th century before the Civil War. On this side of the wall, let's say the right side from you, we have mostly people born in the 18th century, and most of them came from Africa. And this side of the wall, the oldest side of the wall, I call it the indigo generation. And let me tell you, indigo is a dye, it's a blue dye. And once they extract that indigo from the plant, they export it to Europe, where they made those cloth fabrics that were also used in the African slave trade along the coast of Africa.
But it was very dangerous to produce indigo, wasn't it?
The life expectancy of someone who was an indigo maker because of the chemicals they use was like 7 years. We don't have really a scientific study that can confirm that. But we have some testimonies from people who were enslaved on this plantation and who said it was a very dangerous kind of process. And it became even more dangerous for the people who were enslaved on this plantation when sugar became the main product on these plantations. And that happened late in the 18th century and well into the 19th century. And that's why on the other side of the wall, we have people born mostly in America. Many of them came from the East Coast because it was against the law to import slaves from Africa. And I call it the sugar generation.
Why was sugar more dangerous than even indigo?
Sugar was, let's say, very demanding in terms of labor. Cooking the sugar was a very dangerous process. It was cooked on a series of 4 kettles on fire. And they had to leave the burning liquids from kettle to kettle with long ladles. Sometimes you would have accidents, you know, people burning to death. It is not surprising that in 1811, the largest slave revolt ever in the United States, in the south of the United States, happened here in St. James Parish, between here and New Orleans, when hundreds of slaves decided to go down and capture the city of New Orleans. They had rifles. Some of them had only their tools or sticks. And of course, it was a bloodbath. Many were killed in the action. Some were taken to a special court, condemned to death. They were shot in front of the plantations where they belong, and they were beheaded and their heads posted on poles. Slavery in Louisiana in 19th century was really harder. It is harsher on the people who lived around here.
When we return from a short break, our tour of Whitney Plantation continues. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Now, our tour of the Whitney Plantation and Museum continues with Professor Ibrahima Sek. Our next stop was a memorial dedicated to all of Louisiana's slave inhabitants.
So this is what we call the Gwendolyn Midler Hall Alleys, Les Allées Gwendolyn Midler Hall. Like I told you, Gwendolyn Midler Hall played a very important role in the study of Africans in colonial Louisiana. And she also built a database, the Louisiana Slave Database, and she has like 107,000 entries. What we did is pretty simple. We downloaded the names from the database, and then we gave it to the technician who engraved them on granite slabs. On every slab, you have 2 quotes from the former slaves and 1 picture related to slavery. 18 walls, on each wall we have 12 slabs, 216 slabs, 107,000 names. And this memorial here is just the half of what we want to do here.
She stopped the database in 1820. We plan to extend it to 1865, and we'll have thousands and thousands of names which we will put on walls on the other side of this field here.
When you look at these and read these, is there one in particular that stands out to you that just that disturbs you tremendously?
Like this one here?
Yes.
You can read it.
I can read it.
You have better English than me.
It says, "I was sold from my ma. All my brothers and sisters was sold. The man that brought me said he was going to bring us where the money grew on trees. And you know what that was? Picking moss. That man kept me until peace was declared. Martha, Adeline, Annie, Carlina, Tilda are the sisters I remember. I just sit here and wonder sometimes what become of them."
Let me show you something else.
Nobody in the world ever got a chance to know as much misery as a slave that had escaped and been caught.
Whoever said this, you know, was a former slave, and if you read the slave code established by the French, it is said in that code, Article 32, if a slave run away and is captured for the first time, like after 30 days of being absent, the punishment would be being branded on one shoulder with the fleur-de-lis and the ears would be cut. They cut the ears, so it becomes your identity. And whoever see you around, they would know that you are a Negro Marron, you are used to run away. You run away a second time, they brand you on the other shoulder with the fleur-de-lis, and then they cut your hamstring. If you know what a hamstring is, and imagine someone putting a knife to that hamstring, that was really something. The third time, it was the death penalty. Period.
From there, we moved to a section of the memorial featuring a bronze sculpture of an angel carrying an innocent slave child destined for heaven. This is Whitney Plantation's Field of Angels.
We call it the Field of Angels because this is a memorial where we honor the memories of children who died in slavery. Like I told you, children are a very important part of the way we tell the story of slavery here at Whitney. And here we have like 2,200 names of children who died in this parish in a period of 40 years from 1823 to 1863. And among those children who died here, 40 died on this plantation. And I'm sure that all the children who died in this parish are not documented by the Catholic Church. Many of them died naturally from diseases like yellow fever, cholera, malaria. Some died accidentally. Many drowned. Some of them died of burns. Some of them were hit by lightning in the field because children work. It was officially written in the Civil Code of Louisiana that once you reach the age of 10, they can sell you anytime they want it. 10 years old is still little, you know. That's why I hate to bring here my son who is just 10 years old. I hate to bring him here. And sometimes if I have a group of visitors, they have children, I would ask what is the age of that child. And I would ask the mother or the father, can you imagine you being enslaved here on this plantation and someone come and take that child from you? That make them think. We have some quotes over here. One of them said he was put to the plow at age 8. He was just 8 years old when he was put to the plow. They just had breaking.
Next, Whitney Plantation slave quarters.
So here we are in a slave cabin. They had 22 slave cabins on the Heidel plantations, 20 for the field hands and 2 for the domestic slaves near the big house. And the question I always get is how many people lived on a cabin like this? My usual answer is just to tell them to do the math. At the peak of this plantation, they had, like I said, 22 slave cabins and somewhere near 200 slaves. And do the math, it will take you somewhere between 7 and 8 and maybe more for each cabin. I have read some testimonies, a lady who said she lived with her mother and 5 siblings, 1 room, 1 bed. It was horrible during the summer, but they were comfortable during the winter because of that body heat. And at night, could be very noisy around here. They leave early in the morning before daybreak, and they come back when the sun goes down. That's why they say they worked from Kensi to Kensi. Once you come back, you have to wash your body. Or maybe you have to also think about food. Because you have to leave this cabin early in the morning, you have breakfast into the field. You have to cook your breakfast at night before you go to bed. And also cook your dinner. So they have a fireplace. But usually these people mostly cooked outside. Around these cabins, they had also little gardens.
What would a typical dinner and breakfast be that they're preparing in an evening?
Things like grits, corn, because they were given also a certain amount of meat every week. And maybe they would improve it with the kind of crops they got from Africa, like black-eyed peas, okra, things like that.
From the slave quarters, we headed to the plantation kitchen. Built in the late 18th century, it stands as the oldest detached kitchen in Louisiana.
So here we are in the kitchen. This kitchen was built at the same time as the big house in the late 18th century, around 1790. On every inventory of this plantation, you find female slaves serving as cooks. Usually it is a head cook, a lady, and a younger female serving as an assistant. And I imagine that these ladies would use recipes from African cooking tradition, from African food ways, European food ways, and of course, indigenous people food ways. And I think it was through that mixture of different food ways that was born the Creole food ways. And it is not surprising that the cuisine of Louisiana is so rich because it borrows to many traditions. And of course, among those traditions, we cannot ignore the contribution of African foodways. This is a mortar and a pestle. The people who were deported from Africa were put in those boats almost naked. But you know, you don't need a suitcase to pack your culture. Once they made it over here, if you take the example of rice, they were put in the field to produce rice. They did it because they knew how to do it. But also, they reproduced the tools they use in Africa to process rice, like the mortar and the pestle. And that's how these tools also survived over here. It's about material culture. And this is the main tool they use here in Louisiana until the early 20th century. You can see it in pictures. There's a famous picture of a Cajun lady in 1904 in Crowley, Louisiana, grinding rice, processing rice with a mortar and a pestle. This is also an African legacy, material culture. Mm-hmm.
For our final stop in the tour, Dr. Seck took us to the big house.
Ambrose Heidel came from Germany in 1721. He came here with the French Company of the West Indies, and he's the one who bought this plantation in 1752. It was an indigo plantation.
And after he died, Jean-Jacques Heidel became the owner of the plantation, and he's the one who transitioned the plantation from indigo to sugar. This Heidel plantation is really important in the history of slavery of Louisiana, because if you look at the history of slavery over here and also the evolution of the material culture, the building and all of that, it gives you a very accurate reading of the evolution of a plantation along this river road. And most of the outbuildings, the big house, are very well preserved. And I think for that, it makes this place really special. We are thankful, we are lucky to have these structures, but our focus is not about the structures. It's about the people who built these structures, the people who worked into these structures and around these structures, you see. We are in the big house. The big house was the domain of the domestic slaves. We talked about the cooks in that kitchen. We have also people who were weavers to make cloth, spinners to make the thread, if you make the cloth, seamstresses, because they made clothing over here. All the clothes of the slaves probably were made here. They have people who did the laundry, wash clothes and iron. These people cleaned the house. They did also some gardening around the big house for the master. They raised poultry, they raised pigeons. You have two pigeoniers outside here. And squab was a delicacy on this place. So that's a deliberate choice, and we think it is the right choice to focus on the lives of the people who made these people wealthy and comfortable. And slavery was a very comfortable institution for the people who dominated the society, for the slave owners. And that's why we understand why they decided to fight a long war in order to keep the institution of slavery. But, I think we are doing the right thing, telling the story of slavery.
Professor Ibrahim Asek at the Whitney Plantation in St. John the Baptist Parish. What is the true story of the history of okra in North America? Stay tuned, and we'll solve that mystery when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Ralph's on the Park, where this summer you can choose from over a dozen of Chef Chip Flanagan's inventive small plates and sip a glass of wine for an affordable, light, seasonal meal overlooking the lush foliage and towering oaks of City Park at 900 City Park Avenue in New Orleans' mid-city. Here is this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is the true story of okra's history in North America? Over the years, I've often heard the tale of how African slaves were responsible for bringing okra to America. It's said that they smuggled in the seeds of the okra plant, hidden in their hair or ears. Not only is this theory ridiculous, it insults the very people who suffered the outrage of slavery. In fact, it was the slave traders who recognized okra as cheap fodder for the enslaved peoples, and they're the ones responsible for the importation of the plant, indigenous to Ethiopia. Once here, it was the black hand who stirred the pots, who shared this delicious vegetable, which was known as kingumbo in the native Bantu tongue. Many believe kingumbo to be the source of the name of Louisiana's famed soup, gumbo. So the next time you sit down to a steaming bowl of gumbo, remember those whose suffering brought that delicious concoction to the table. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Following our in-depth tour of the plantation, I had some lingering questions about the Haydell family lineage. Based on John Cummings' knowledge of the plantation and his friendship with one of the Haydell's notable descendants, Sybil Haydell Morial, we asked John to explain the Haydell's family connection to Whitney Plantation.
Well, I knew that the Haydells came from a plantation somewhere on the river. But what's interesting is that her ancestor is a slave woman by the name of Anna. Anna came from the East Coast, we think from Philadelphia. And she was a gift to Ozalie Haydell, who was the mistress of the house. And Ozalie had no children. She had a brother named Antoine, who lived with her. And Marcelin Haydell died in 1839, her husband. So her brother impregnated Anna, and the child was Victor Haydell. And he married Beatrice, and they had children. And from that union, every black Haydell followed.
To hear this remarkable story in Mrs. Morial's own words, we invited her to sit down with us in our Louisiana Eats studio.
Let me take you on the road from slavery to my generation.
Apart from her lifelong work as an educator and an activist, Sybil also served as First Lady of New Orleans, as wife of the city's first African-American mayor, Ernest N. Morial. Sybil chronicled her breadth of experience during the Civil Rights era and the years that followed in her memoir, Witness to Change. As our conversation began, I asked Sybil what she knew about her family's lineage before the Whitney Plantation Museum opened.
I had no knowledge of before my grandfather, who was Clay. I knew that his father was Pepea, but I did not know that he was a slave. His name was Victor, and he was the son of an African slave that worked in the house and a member of the Haydell family, the owners of the plantation. He was the only child of that union. And some years ago, in 2009, my Haydell side of the family had a reunion. There were about 264 of us. And one of my cousins had researched our ancestry. And that's when I learned much about it, but never the slave part. We didn't talk about that. The older people, my elder cousins and grandparents, never talked about the slave level, the slave generation. But then when John Cummings bought the plantation and had a historian, a Senegalese historian, who authenticated all of it, then we really knew we could trace it all the way back to Germany and Africa.
That's incredible. How did you feel once you learned this incredible tie to your past and the horror of slavery?
We did not, I don't know, maybe we knew not to step into it. But had we thought about the years that my grandfather and great-grandfather lived, we would have put it together. But maybe unintentionally, we didn't want to know. We didn't want to know the real facts of our slave background. And so this plantation that John Cummings has made a slave museum and that has been thoroughly researched by Dr. Seck gave it all. I mean, we even have the copy of my slave great-grandfather's baptismal certificate, which lists Anna, who was the African slave, and Antoine, who was the German. And we learned that all of my family were owned by the Germans, and there was a price on their heads. That really made me really sad. That was really hard for me to reckon with, and hard to think about the life of a slave who, it was never going to be any different. There was nothing to look forward to. It was, you're a slave, and this is where you're going to live for the rest of your life.
I think that it's very interesting that in your memoir, you cover a lot of your growing up, and maybe part of the reason that you all never looked back that far might be because, as you describe your family in your memoir, you came from great privilege, despite the fact that you all were living in the Jim Crow segregated South. Tell us a little bit about that, because I don't know that everybody really fully understands how, for generations, people who come from your background are and have been.
My great-grandfather, the mulatto, was 28 years old when the Emancipation Proclamation became law. He was freed at 28. In 10 years, he owned property. He had his own little plot of land where he raised sugarcane and rice and made a living off it. Now, his children, he had 8 sons. My grandfather was one. They also owned land. In fact, it was the Heidel brothers together that owned land that farmed sugarcane. But my grandfather, whose name was Clay, was also part owner of a grocery store in Reserve, which is where his wife's family came from, the Orrip plantation. So my grandfather wanted his 9 children to be educated. Now, back then, the schools, after the Emancipation Proclamation, schools for Negroes only went up to 5th grade. They did not want them to be more educated beyond that. So my grandfather sent my father, who was the oldest of 9 children, to New Orleans to finish his education, and he did, 5th grade on through high school, and then he went to Straight College, which was a black college in New Orleans. From there, he went to Howard University in Washington, D.C., couldn't attend the medical schools in the state because Negroes were barred from that. So my father got a medical education and came back to New Orleans to practice and became a very successful physician and surgeon. Now, the promise had to be to his parents that he would help to educate his siblings. And he did that. I know he did, because his youngest brother was maybe 15 years older than my sister and me. He would come for his tuition. He went to Dillard for Dad at the beginning of each semester. So he fulfilled his promise to his family. And that's how we got ahead. But from slavery to home ownership to education, professional education, and that's where we were. We were, I guess, you know, very well off, very comfortable. But when we stepped outside our little cocoon, we had to sit behind the bus. We couldn't go to any public places. We were publicly humiliated. Mm-hmm. And so our parents tried to shield us from that. The families and the friends were very close, and they provided opportunities for us. We couldn't go to the symphony, and we could go to the opera and sit way up at the nosebleed, because my mother loved the opera, and we went. But then they took us to Dillard, that had a great theater department, to plays. Dillard also had internationally famous African-Americans like Paul Robeson and Anne Brown, who was the first Bess in Porgy and Bess. So we had those kinds of exposures. And then Xavier University had opera. So we got what we were barred from. But, you know, we still knew that we were not whole, that we could not go everywhere.
One of the things that I read was that apparently your family, with the importance that you place on education, they didn't send you to Xavier or Dillard. When you went to college, you went to Boston University.
But I did go to Xavier for 2 years.
Okay.
I was very young, And my parents said, wait a couple of years. So I transferred to Boston University, getting all of my credits. So I transferred as a junior and got my bachelor's degree and then my master's degree from Boston University.
And tell us the story of your trip to Boston University. How did you get there?
That was a train ride from hell. The trains were segregated. African-Americans had, we were called Negroes then, or colored, had to sit in the baggage car. Now, we weren't looking at the baggage, but there was a big wall that separated us, so it was half of a train car. We had to sit there. And that year, maybe the year before, because of a federal lawsuit outlawing interstate segregation on transportation, we could go in the dining room. But that was quite an experience. Number one, the conductor never told me. My father said, you can go in the dining room, but the conductor will announce it, the time for dinner. And you'd probably have to move back a few cars. Well, the conductor never came. Mm-hmm. I walked through and met the conductor. I said, where is the dining car and is dinner being served? And he reluctantly told me. Well, when I got to the dining car, I was standing up waiting to be seated, and other people were being seated, and I was accustomed to that. You know, you're last, just like in the stores, you're the last served. They escorted me to a table right at the kitchen, and then they pulled this curtain around it. So white people didn't have to look at us. Now, the comforting thing was that the chefs in the kitchen and all of the waiters were African-Americans. And so they were lovely. They deferred. And I guess they said, I'm sorry, you know, have to be here. And I would have to be here, too. But they took very good care of me. And then I went back to the colored car. We could not rent an overnight, a Pullman car to sleep. So you sat up for a 30-hour train ride. Mm. It was humiliating, but we didn't know anything else. We just knew it wasn't right.
So then what was it like for you in Boston? How different was your life experience when you were that far north?
Well, I had traveled a lot with my parents, my siblings, and I. Daddy would go to national conventions, the doctor's convention, the insurance conventions, and take us with him. So we were exposed to being able to go anywhere. But I was thrilled to be able to go to the theater and to the opera and to the Boston Pops, which was wonderful, and to the museums without any hesitation, you know, that we would be rejected or that we would be treated poorly. So I loved the freedom. And when the Supreme Court decision came down in 1954, all of us from the South, like the North, we all pledged to the very person to come back South and be a part of the change. And one of those students was Martin Luther King. He was a student at Boston University. He was in graduate school. I was in undergraduate school. And we had conversations. Oh, we're going home. We had no idea what the change would mean, what we have to do. This was a whole new challenge. And so we all came back home. And you know what Martin Luther King became. And one of the students from Alabama was the first black elected to the legislature, as my husband was. So we wanted to be in the mix. We wanted to contribute.
It must have been very exciting.
It was. It was heady stuff, really.
And when you look back, how does it feel to have such a broad view of change in the world?
Well, you know, I didn't really realize it until I wrote the memoir. You know, I began after Katrina. I had my house flooded. I went to Baton Rouge, where I had a daughter. She lost her house also. Mm. But while I was dealing with the tragedies, I had flood, and then I had fire. So it wiped out all of my memorabilia, photographs, and all the little things that signified events in our lives. So I began to think about my life and reminisce on the good things. And I would lie in bed at night and just go into detail, you know, what was the time of year. And the next morning, I'd get up and get on a computer and put the story down. And when I had about 15 or so stories, I said, I've got a book. I want to do this for my children and grandchildren. So that really was cathartic. It healed me while I was dealing with the tragedies, which were significant. And many of us in New Orleans really had these major, major, major problems to deal with. But out of it came this memoir, and I could really take a broad look at my life, my great fortune. And you know what? The challenges enriched my life. I would tell my children, adversity builds character, and they would look at me, you know, what do you mean? It's true. When you have to deal with these, it strengthens your character, it strengthens your reserve, it gives you the courage to deal with it and land on your feet.
What's your greatest hope for the future?
Well, I hope that we can face what our attitudes are, both on the black side and the white side. We have to talk about race. It is a problem. And we have to do, I think, what South Africa did. And they knew that if they did not resolve their differences, they would all be destroyed. The economy would fail. There would be violence and so forth. So they had race and reconciliation. They talked it out. They apologized on both sides for what they'd done. They gave up their guilt. They shook off the guilt that they had for the wrong things that they had done on both sides. And I think that's where we have to start now, because we are slipping back, and that shouldn't be happening. We are all created equal. And all except the slaves and the Native Americans are immigrants of this country. Mm-hmm. So we need to get it right.
What do you hope that you'll be most remembered for? What's the legacy that you hope that you leave for the future?
I think really it's my children, that they have a sense of commitment to make this a more humane society, both in their professional and their personal lives. But I think that my story will make people aware of the gains that we've made, of the things that can threaten all of us. And I just think a first story written is much easier to grasp than a historical report. Of course, we have the history. And in some of the things that I said in my memoir, even though it's in my memory, I went to the archives to be sure I had dates right, I had the right language in some instances. So it is really, everything is authentic there. But it's much easier reading someone's story or hearing someone's oral history, because it gets to you. You know, it's real. This is a human being's story.
Educator and community leader, Sybil Heidel-Morial. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we take a trip to Maryland's Place, a popular casual dining hotspot in Shreveport.
If 3, 4, 5 of us are gathered in the name of Maryland's, it's a good, good thing.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, by the Palace Cafe, home of the crab meat cheesecake and white chocolate bread pudding, in the historic Whirline Music Building on Canal Street, and by Toujac's Restaurant, home of America's oldest stand-up bar, now celebrating 160 years on Decatur Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris.
Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.